KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego, presenting The Science of Story, an immersive six-day event series of concert, conversations, movies, and workshops that explores the art, craft, and cultural power of storytelling from July 22nd to 27th. Tickets at artpower.ucsd.edu.
It's time for KPBS Midday Edition. On today's show, while federal policies and rhetoric target LGBTQ plus youth, locally, they're finding support and ways to express themselves through art. I'm Jade Hindman with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. The impact of Trump's move to shut down the suicide hotline for LGBTQ plus youth.
What's happening to that 67% of our youth that don't have supportive households, that they don't have the access to this crisis line?
We'll tell you about resources standing in the gap and programs that amplify voices trying to be silenced. That's ahead on Midday Edition. Today marks the beginning of Pride Week in San Diego. It's a time of celebration, education, and resistance. But this time it's happening amid the Trump administration's anti-LGBTQ plus policy changes. And much of the legislation has a specific focus on youth, from nationwide bans on gender-affirming care to the exclusion of trans athletes in high school girls' sports and book bans with LGBTQ plus themes and representation. My next two guests work closely with LGBTQ plus youth and are seeing the impacts of these vast policy shifts on them and their families. Kathy Molig is the founder and executive director of Trans Family Support Services. Kathy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Very happy to be here.
So glad to have you with us again. Also with us is Lou Felipe, a clinical psychologist and associate professor at the University of Denver. She practices in both California and Colorado. Lou, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, Kathy, last month, the Supreme Court upheld Tennessee's ban on hormone treatments and puberty blockers for minors. Both of these are those really fall under this larger umbrella of gender-affirming care. So first, remind us what gender-affirming care means and what it encompasses.
Yeah, so, you know, this is medically necessary treatment that has been happening for transgender individuals for decades. It is not something new. It just seems to be something new. And so the protocol, first off, is that's really important for people to understand is that no children are getting any kind of medical treatment. Treatment does not start until someone is in adolescence and has actually started puberty. And then there are puberty blockers, which kind of pause that puberty. Oftentimes, clinicians speak in terminology of it gives the family time. It gives the individual time to be able to really know who they are. And then other forms of care are hormone replacement therapy, HRT, that individuals, again, working with a team of, when we're talking about our adolescents, it includes parents, doctors, mental health providers. And then for our adults, there are surgeries that happen that can be part of gender-affirming care, but that's not something that we're seeing very often for our young people. In rare cases, some of our older teens and getting close to young adults may access some surgeries, but that is not the commonplace.
Yeah, well, Trans Family Support Services has really been at the forefront of this fight for gender-affirming care for many years. What was your reaction to finding out the ban was upheld?
Yeah, you know, it was devastating to us and the families we serve. We have served nearly 7,000 trans individuals and their families across the country. We're based here in San Diego, and so the majority of our families do live in California. The Scarametti case was one that we really were hopeful would help us in turning the tide a little bit. We have 24 states currently that have a ban against this care for minors, and calling minors anyone under the age of 19. So even though, you know, we look in our country as adults are 18, that's when you can vote and those sorts of things, you can't consent to your own health care at 18 when it comes to gender affirming care. And so it is really devastating and really opens the door for more of this anti-trans rhetoric and the political climate to push even further against our health care.
And we're seeing, you know, the fallout all over California. I mean, the Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, which was one of the premier clinics for gender-affirming care, is closing that clinic's doors next week. What does this mean and say about the public health landscape for queer and trans youth right now?
So it's a scary time to be a trans youth, for sure. And you know, we've kind of had this ramp off of this, starting with the election and a lot of the anti-trans rhetoric that started there. But for our kids in particular in Southern California, you know, Children's Hospital Los Angeles is a premier clinic. It is the one that is looked to from other clinics across the country. They've been doing the care for decades and really, really are considered experts in this field. And so to have them close, they serve nearly 3,000 patients. So if we think about thousands of people now trying to access care in a system that is already lacking in capacity, other clinics across the state just aren't going to be able to take on all of these new families, and also losing the expertise of these medical and mental health providers, because they're also closing the mental health portion of the program. Losing these clinicians who have been doing this work for so long and their expertise, it is a very, very devastating move.
And Lou, you know, I know mental health care can be very affirming for young people who are still navigating their identity. Can you talk more about that and what that care can look like?
Well, from a psychotherapy perspective, gender affirming care does not treat one's sexual orientation or gender identity as a pathology, but rather looks for ways to validate one's experience in their sexual orientation and in their gender.
And, you know, when gender-affirming care becomes more difficult to access, how does it impact the mental health of kids and teens?
You know, for LGBTQ plus young people, their worlds are already quite difficult. In California, you know, we have 35% of LGBTQ plus youth seriously consider suicide, and 39% of transgender and non-binary young people. And in California, 11% of LGBTQ plus young people attempted suicide, which also includes 14% of transgender and non-binary young people. So when we don't have these services, these rates are only looking to increase. You know, for youth overall, between the ages of 10 and 14 years, suicide is the second leading cause of death. And these rates are just four times more than that for LGBTQ plus youth.
So, Lou, more recently, the Trump administration shut down a suicide prevention hotline specifically serving LGBTQ plus youth. And more than 1.3 million queer youth facing a mental health crisis have dialed that line since it first launched in 2022. What do you see as the immediate impact of this?
The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline was something that is so accessible to LGBTQ plus youth. And so the elimination of that creates additional barriers and challenges for an already vulnerable group. So it takes away this service where you have counselors and service providers who are trained in treating LGBTQ plus youth with sensitivity and with humanity and with care. And this could really impact the already staggering rates of mood disorders and suicide attempts and suicide ideation. So it's a huge service that has been taken away from youth across the nation.
Yeah. Well, how would you describe the state of mental health care right now for the LGBTQ plus community? I mean, what services are still available, particularly for young people?
Well, it makes it, you know, what is difficult is that with funding federally being reduced across the board, and particularly in places like in education where young people can really access well-trained and sensitive LGBT-oriented services, you know, this really takes away the ability for those services to be held consistently. You know, I do think that services will continue to be provided, but they're just harder to be able to connect to and access. An important place like the public school system have increased limitations and barriers to be able to do that openly and to receive the funding that they need to get the proper training and to have enough counselors on hand to be able to address the need that is there.
Kathy, this also impacts families. So how are the parents of queer and trans youth navigating this moment?
Yeah, you know, our parents that have kiddos, they're in these affirming homes, they're terrified. Our parents are scared about the subpoenas that have gone out to clinics and providers across the country from the U.S. Attorney General. They're concerned about their kids' private medical records being accessed, and they're concerned about where they're going to be able to get care. I have had dozens of families that we have worked with that have left the country because they feel like they are not safe as a family with a trans youth. And I want to, if I can just take a minute, Jade, to talk a second about what Lou just brought up in this piece about, you know, the accessibility of that crisis line. The Trevor Project says that only 33% of our trans youth claim that they live in households that are affirming. So what's happening to that 67% of our youth that don't have supportive households, that they don't have the access to this crisis line? They're not getting the access to the mental health care that they need at school. They're not going to get it at home. Their parents aren't going to be advocating for it. Those are the kids that I feel are most at risk. And those are the kids that we see within our programming that need the most support.
Well, you know, for a long time, California was seen as safe from anti-LGBTQ plus policies passed across the country. But I'm curious, I mean, is that the case anymore?
No, absolutely not. Our families do not see California as a safe place. Our governor has gone on multiple podcasts talking against the community. Our institutions are folding to this pressure that they're getting from the federal government. So no, we don't feel safe here. At the same time that we're fighting to hold on to what we do have, we've seen for years now school boards trying to change their policies and stepping outside of state laws that allow for inclusivity. So this has been an ongoing attack that starts at the local level and has gone all the way up to the federal level. So I unequivocally can say our families do not feel safe in California.
And Lou, though you're in Colorado, you are still seeing clients in California. So is that something you're also seeing?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, and according to the Trevor Project, who does, you know, this organization does extraordinary work in being able to track, you know, the experiences for LGBTQ plus youth on a number of domains. And among them, they're looking at, you know, how does the political landscape impact, you know, the mental health? And 90% of the youth that they surveyed do say that the political landscape negatively affects them, especially when it's hostile, right? So when there's a larger community in a context nationally that is not supporting, you know, youth in their sexual orientation and gender identity, this does impact outcomes, including depression, anxiety, substance use, and suicide rates. I will say, though, you know, as we're talking about families, and we're talking on these kind of larger scales, you know, where California may have made some very disappointing moves federally, there are some very disappointing moves. There's also some hopefulness in that, you know, there could be like a single affirming person in a young person's life, and a person who's of an LGBTQ plus identity that can really protect from some of these other risks to poor mental health outcomes. And this isn't to say that that makes this context okay, but however, you know, in whatever way we might discuss some of the risks for being simply LGBTQ in this context, it's horrific. In all the ways that I've mentioned. And there's also hopefulness that a single person or a small community of people can also protect these youth and buffer against some of the really horrific risks that are out there and threats that are surrounding them.
We continue the conversation about how policy shifts are impacting LGBTQ plus youth when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Marichal Design and Remodeling, helping homeowners with their home remodeling needs. From ADUs to kitchen remodels, room additions, and custom homes, Marichal Design and Remodeling can help homeowners design and build their dream homes. More at trustyourhometous.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. I'm here with Kathy Molig, the founder and executive director of Trans Family Support Services, along with Lou Felipe, a clinical psychologist and associate professor at the University of Denver. We're talking about the different challenges LGBTQ plus youth are navigating in the face of growing anti-LGBTQ legislation, as well as the ongoing efforts to resist it. So, Lou, you mentioned hope a little earlier. How are you talking to your clients and families through this moment and uncertainty of the political and social landscape?
I mean, there's a part of me that is pragmatic in looking at the landscape that is there and the real risks that exist for youth and their families. And so if they are, you know, looking for an out, looking for a different place to be, I do walk through with them what the real risks are and what the real benefits might be of moving, of looking in to be in a different place where they can find stronger relationships and more, you know, affirming experiences across the board. With that said, though, you know, I don't necessarily stay in the place of looking at only the threats, but also looking at where are the spaces of celebration and of affirmation and of liberation that you can experience, and how do you extend that network? Because it'll be important, as I said, when the threats start to mount on a state level, on a regional level, on a national level, it's important to see where in your daily life, in one's daily life, you can experience moments of safety, security, validation, and affirmation.
And Kathy, what are the conversations you're having?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things, and I hope I can take a moment to really address if there are any trans individuals, and particularly trans youth or their parents listening, that we talk in terms of gender-affirming care is far more than just this medical care. And while it may feel like that might not be available to you sometime in the future, we don't know that for sure. And also, thinking about all the other ways that we can do gender-affirming care. I know in the beginning of this, I talked about the medical piece, but the mental health piece that Lou has been talking about, that just having people who are affirming you and seeing you for who you are, using your name, using your pronouns, having the expression, dress, your hairstyle, all of that is part of gender-affirming care. No entity, no political figure, no government can take away our identities. So I think that's important to note. Also, the fact that while we don't feel safe in California, we still have all the same state laws that we have always had. And while we've had a clinic close, CHLA has stepped outside of what the state laws are. And the attorney general, I know, is watching all the other clinics in the state. We still have the same inclusivity at schools. We still have the same inclusivity for sports. So while things are at threat to being removed, we are not there yet in the state of California in particular, which is why I said holding on to the rights we have now becomes the fight for the advocacy folks.
How are organizations like Trans Family Support Services banding together right now? How are you continuing to advocate for gender-affirming care and trans rights in general?
So we also have a sister organization called the Alliance for Trans Youth Rights that does a lot more of the advocating piece. And we are joining in coalitions. I believe very strongly we're only going to win these fights if we're all working in collaboration together. So, you know, we have the core four here in San Diego, which is us, the San Diego LGBT Center, the North County LGBTQ Resource Center in Oceanside, and San Diego Pride. So that all four of our organizations can come together in a more powerful voice. I do that also on the state level. There's multiple coalitions that we work with to be able to bring education to our state legislators, to the governor's office, the attorney general's office, working with all of these different leadership entities. And then we have national tables that we belong to, where we're really working to see where are the places at which we can get a win. How can we help to message this information? How can we educate folks to what that Supreme Court case really does and doesn't do so that we can continue to bring hope to the community?
Hmm. Well, are there other important intersections and issues facing LGBTQ plus youth that we haven't talked about so far? Lou?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is, for youth of color, you know, some of the risks to their mental health are increased. So when you have intersections of oppression that include not only, you know, a targeted discrimination based on sexual identity or sexual orientation or gender identity, you also include aspects of racism and other types of sexism that only works to even further compound the impacts of depression, anxiety, and suicidality among young people. So I think it's important to recognize where one might have intersections of identity. So for Native Indigenous youth, for example, their rates are closer to 40% to 50% of considering suicide. And that is absolutely unacceptable, you know. So when we think about inclusivity and justice, we do have to consider how we are working for protecting the rights of individuals and communities who might be marginalized on other statuses as well, just as much as we want to protect and uphold the rights and dignity for LGBT plus people.
Hmm. Kathy, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think important point that Lou's making. And when we think about our immigrant community here, especially in Southern California, with the ICE raids that have been going on, we're a bilingual organization, and the terror of families that, you know, even just accessing care, kids going to school, any of those things that, you know, parents are afraid to go to their jobs because they aren't sure that they're going to make it home for their kids. And then when you add to that, that they're also fighting the fight around, you know, getting their kid access to healthcare for transition, that's a heavy load for families to be able to kind of wade their way through. So when we think about the attacks, the political climate and the political attacks that are coming on folks that have shared intersectionalities between gender identity or sexual orientation and being families of immigrants, it is a incredible load that they are carrying right now.
Hmm. Well, these attacks and policy changes impacting the LGBTQ community are far-reaching, but this rhetoric is not new. I mean, how are you looking to the past and using it to inform the present? Kathy?
You know, it's not new. And something we hold town halls when significant things happen, like the Scarametti case dropped and the closure of Children's Hospital Los Angeles. And I repeatedly tell our families, you know, first and foremost, as parents of trans individuals, regardless of their age, our job is to build resilience in our kids, because even before we hit this political climate, the world's not ready for our kids. We have to teach them to be resilient. But that comes within being a member of the LGBTQ community. When we think back to the history, when we can look across decades and decades, that while there was oppression, that was followed by great progress. And if we think about, for those of us that are old enough to know or have the history piece of the Anita Bryant years and the extreme homophobia, and that the gay community at that time could have never imagined having same-sex marriage. And yet here we are.
Yeah. Lou, what are your thoughts?
You know, as someone who is also part of the community, as being part of the queer community, I really look to the models provided by queer ancestors. And you see kind of like my tone shift a little bit when talking about this, because there have been ways that our communities and our peoples have not been supported in being celebrated, visible, seen, and centered over time. And yet here we are. Right. As Kathy was saying, like, I didn't think in my lifetime marriage would be a possibility. And I'm a person who is happily married. Right. So I think there are ways when I, you know, something that I really love about my profession is the ability to think expansively and understand kind of how context might impact one psyche. But I could also look on a smaller scale. You know, what can smaller communities do? How do people join with chosen family members to create protection, security, and validation, right? And I think we have a number of kind of anecdotal experiences and narratives to pull from to guide us through a political context that is really harrowing.
Hmm. Are there any resources you recommend to queer and trans youth and their families that could help them navigate this moment?
I think it's important. Certainly, I would send trans kids to us. Our youth programming is open for all LGBTQ youth from middle school up to age 30. So happy to get people involved in our community groups to be able to get that support. But I think too, and I think Lou may have said something about this earlier of, you know, find that one person or those two people, find the people in your world that are going to see you for who you are and celebrate you for who you are. And for our families, getting connected to other families, you don't have to go through this alone. There is a wide community of very welcoming people who want to be able to love on your kids too and to support you through this hard bit. Just being able to have other people that understand that watching your kid go to school every day can be terrorizing and not sure what they're going to face while they're at school. It's a remarkable thing to have that level of community. So I really recommend that listeners find that community wherever you can, whether it's at one of our LGBT centers that we have across Southern California with an agency like ours. And then I'll let Lou talk about the importance of mental health.
Yeah, I would say, you know, the Trevor Project continues as a website and a resource for people across the nation to be able to access. And, you know, for young people that, you know, they're so adept at being able to access online resources. And I would say that is still there, you know, and as much as there might be this kind of war on getting educated and having books, the literature that really centers the LGBTQ plus experience is just very vast. And there are books and periodicals and other types of media that are developmentally appropriate for people across the lifespan to be able to access. People won't stop writing. People won't stop creating poetry. People won't stop creating music. And so the visibility will still be there in these spaces to be able to find one's own experience reflected in others. And it is important to find community, to know that there is belongingness and a sense of connection with other people and part of a group that can be celebrated and upheld. So this is where, you know, Kathy and I both going back to like the importance of the one person, right? Or, you know, to show up for that family member who you know, you know, there might be extended family who have a lot of reservations about the way they express themselves or the way that they affirm their identity. And it would be helpful to have like that, even an extended family member show up with pride and with confidence and with care. I think if we could look at our relationships and the relationship networks that we're a part of with a lot of critique and a lot of intention, I think this is a time when we can't be passive. You know, this is a time where we have to really think proactively about how we could show up for LGBTQ plus youth, because we know and we can see all the threats that are out there.
Well, thank you both so much for sharing your time and your insight with us today. I've been speaking with Lou Felipe, a clinical psychologist and associate professor at the University of Denver, and Kathy Molig, the founder and executive director of Trans Family Support Services. Kathy, Lou, thanks so much again.
Thanks so much for the conversation.
Thank you.
After the break, how one teen program at a local LGBTQ plus theater is reflecting the cultural moment.
I think a program like this, and really the mission of Diversionary, as evidenced by this program, this is why Pride is necessary.
Hear about Diversionary's Teen Versionary program when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org.
You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. Each summer, Diversionary Theater, one of the oldest LGBTQ plus theaters in the country, puts on a program that gives teens creative control both on and off the stage. It's called Teen Versionary and gives LGBTQ plus youth and allies the space to make theater and art out of the issues that matter to them. I'm here with Wilfred Paloma. He's the Director of Arts Education and Community Engagement at Diversionary. Hey, Wilfred.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, good. Also with us is one of the teen participants and incoming high school senior, Gray Cohen. Gray, welcome to you too.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Glad to have you both here. So, Wilfred, tell us a bit about the Teen Versionary program. I mean, how did it get started?
The program itself really came to be as a sort of answer to the need to have a space, a forum, a canvas for teens in our community to say what's in their heart space, to talk about the issues that are germane to their, you know, existence in the now. And it used to, in its early iteration, take sort of form in these already made compositions, things like the Laramie Project, a production of that, right? Mm-hmm. Dear Harvey is another example. And when I, before I took over as the director of the department, I led several of the programs. This was one of them as the director of that program. And so I was really interested in bringing in a more fluid, sort of what's called devised approach, which is a synthesis, meaning the language in the piece can be amorphous. It's emergent from the different collectives, the different casts, the different ensemble, and all of the different DNA of that, both in the art making, as well as many other, you know, aspects of design and technical sort of things. So now it's turned into sort of a woven patchwork of all these different voices, and every year is new and different.
Speaking of which, what sets this year apart from others, and, you know, and what's the theme?
Ah, so I love this question. We've come to a title, and it's one that I think fits. It's Teen Versionary 2025 is the name of the program, and the name of the production is Mosaic of the Mind. And how it came about, so much of devising is, again, what surfaces in the room, in the conversations, in the different prompting activities. Some of that is visual art. Some of that is in theatrical sort of exercise and different acting, you know, games and so forth. And what emerges from that are sort of bits and pieces of what the collective wants to talk about. And so through a collection of different facilitated exercises and things, we came up with this show. And what it is truly is episodes that encapsulate sort of the absurd reality of what's going on today. Things like AI have come up, things like the current political landscape has come up, but also it transforms into a more heightened poetic section that also sort of the crown jewel of that moment is, I call it the I wish moment, mm-hmm. where every participant sort of says and manifests something that they wish and also want to recognize in the common shared space. So that's this year.
And Gray, I want to pull you in here. How did you first hear about Teen Versionary?
Well, I, during my freshman year of high school, interned with their production manager through my school. And that's kind of how I got introduced to just Diversionary as a whole. And the production manager that was here at the time really encouraged me to come in do this because I was honestly more interested in the acting and writing side of theater. And it took a while, and it took me kind of getting all my ducks in a row in order to come and do this. But I'm very happy I'm doing it.
Yeah. Well, what were some of the big issues and themes you were interested in exploring coming into the program?
What we were presented with as kind of the catalyst of what all of our scenes and the project should stem from was unbreakable pride, unshakable power. And it got me thinking about how queer people are being treated in the media right now, and how queer people are being treated by politicians right now, and how queer people and specifically trans people are being villainized in the media and in politics. So I wanted to kind of take that and take those people that make us as queer and trans youths and just people in general, the people that take us and villainize us, I wanted to take them and make them seem a little absurd, because, I mean, that's how they sound to me. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately I wanted to show that we as queer people can find that pride and power even when there are forces outside of our community and even inside of our community pushing us down and trying to make us seem evil or seem less than.
So tell me a bit about the piece you're working on.
It is like a TED Talk style skit where I play this doctor-ish type character. I call myself a self-proclaimed child psychologist. Mm-hmm. And the intro is basically, how do you deal with unruly children? And over the course of it, you come to realize this unruly child I'm talking about is very, very, very similar to our current president. And the overall message being, how do we not only as the queer community, but also as the American community and the American people get through this time of him being around and making these choices that we don't necessarily agree with or want to happen?
Yeah. Well, I mean, also, I imagine it requires, you know, a lot of trust to have these conversations about what's going on. So how did you sort of build that safe space and feel comfortable to create together?
Well, we did a lot of more trust building in the first week of rehearsals. We wrote a bit, but it was mainly getting to know each other and getting to know how each of us thought of the themes of the show and what within us brought us to this place, brought us to this experience that we're all about to share together. And I know a lot of the other participants were much more reserved than I was. When I get nervous, I overshare a lot, and I was really nervous. So I think those kinds of exercises where we had a few people come up and share something about themselves that was a little more personal, slowly but surely got the whole group into this more trusting and connected place where we could understand where a person was coming from, and we knew that we would not be judged for any sort of perspective we had and anything that we put into words. That's probably what I'd say to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. I would add that in addition to the participants, I have brought together a creative team, some of which are my graduate students or undergraduate students at the various university colleges that I work, to be a part of the facilitation. And what really sort of lifting the veil here is many, if not all of them, are thriving, contributing LGBTQIA plus human beings. And to, in the space, vibrate so clearly in our existence and also to be a part of these exercises. So we're playing together. We're being a family together in a way that allows us to sort of fail, right? And oh my gosh, or speak in draft. But it's also partly adults asking youth in a genuine way, what are your thoughts? What is going on with you? What do you have to say? And for a 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old, I think we can all say, like, those are huge questions as a 36-year-old, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you want to do with your life? And we're actually sitting there, and we're curious. We want to know. And so that the intergenerational property of that, we are speaking up to you as artists. You may not know what that sort of art making Crayola box is fully yet, but we want to embrace you. We want to share our gifts. We also want to invite you into all the different aspects of the, you know, of the making. And we also know that you don't know what you don't know. So in those moments, how then do we shift from a, you know, sort of very forward feeling, we got to build the show, but also hold space for, okay, this is learning. This is exposure. Okay, this is just for fun. And the proportionality of that, that's really my job. That's the facilitating aspect. And I think Gray, correct me if I'm wrong, but we've struck, I think, a pretty good balance.
Well, I mean, Gray, what's been the most fulfilling part for you so far being involved in Teen Versionary?
I think probably the most fulfilling part is being around fellow queer artists. I know I have spaces at school and I have my friend groups that are majorly queer people, but I think this is kind of the first time where I've been in a almost exclusively like queer cast, and I've been able to play off other queer people and their ideas, because I feel in the majority of people, there is kind of a certain way they want to go about things. But I find in mostly queer people, there is no bounds, you know? So being able to not only talk to the other queer participants, but also the queer like artist team, like the adults that are with us, has been really great. That's probably the most fulfilling part.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, you all are in the final stages now. So what excites you most about the production and what do you hope people take away?
In this moment where, you know, we're hearing questions like, why is Pride necessary? Is it still necessary? What is it even? I think the sort of mythos and of the things that we hold as part of our identity. And there are many things, right? It's not just LGBTQIA+. It's the cultural aspects and all those threads. And so I think a program like this, and really the mission of Diversionary, as evidenced by this program, this is why Pride is necessary. It's both to reflect truth and authenticity to the dominant culture, to folks whom may have never met a queer person. It's also to celebrate together, to see ourselves, talk about ourselves, to claim space, to feel substantiated in the space that we hold, both for each other, but also for ourselves. That's deeply vulnerable. And as these places are evaporating, we have to continue to champion that. So I'm hopeful that this is a free program for participants. We don't charge anything for participants, and it's free to the public. So in partnership with San Diego Pride, all of those festival activities, this is happening Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So, you know, any and all people are welcome to our space to bear witness to this production.
I've been speaking with Wilfred Paloma, the Director of Arts Education and Community Engagement at Diversionary Theater, along with Gray Cohen, one of the teens involved in the Teen Versionary program. You can watch the final performances this Friday through Sunday at Diversionary Theater. You can find out more details on Diversionary Theater's website and, of course, on kpbs.org. Wilfred, Gray, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org.